Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Ben Law, woodsman, permaculture practitioner, and author of many books on developing, tending, and using the products that come from the woods. Some of those titles include The Woodland Way and Round Wood Timber Framing. Mr. Law is a wealth of practical knowledge, and we touch on some of that in this conversation. As I seek out guests of this caliber for the show, he is someone who practices what he teaches continuously. It is a complete part of his life and his work practices. Even as I spoke to him, he was out in the woods, running off of solar power. We begin the interview via landline and then switch to his mobile phone. I recommend listening to this episode in a relaxed and quieter environment because of some of those connection issues. This episode is the first for July 2014, and so I'm beginning my summer fundraising campaign. Now that I've decided to keep the show on the air as long as I can, I need your help to keep producing this material and interviewing such great guests as Mr. Law. So if you enjoy this podcast, make a one-time or ongoing contribution. I honestly can't do this without your help. So visit thepermaculturepodcast.com/support to find out how to donate. Now then, on to Mr. Law. I'll join you again with some thoughts and updates.
Well then, Ben, Mr. Law, if you could give myself and the listeners a bit of your biography and background, how you came to do what you're doing, and then we'll take the conversation from there.
Okay, how I came to be doing what I'm doing really goes back to the 1980s, middle of the 80s, and I was living in a small village close by to where I'm in my woods now, and I was involved in sort of conservation landscaping, sort of doing ponds, wildflower meadows, that type of thing, and kept getting these leaflets through the letterbox talking about areas the size of Belgium in the Amazon rainforest being destroyed every day. And I just couldn't really comprehend that something of that scale could be going on. So I guess rather naively at the time, I kind of went out there feeling I could do something about it. And I traveled to South America, different parts of the Amazon rainforest at the end of the 1980s. And although I saw some pretty awful forestry destruction, I also met some amazing people out there who had such a in-depth knowledge of the forest that it kind of made me see what I tend to refer to now as the pattern of the forest dweller, which is a different approach to managing woods and forests, certainly that we have in the UK. So I came back to England with this sort of understanding and desire to try and put in place some of those patterns I'd learned. These are patterns of long-term stewardship of one particular piece of land, so sort of a real understanding of where the migratory species, when they come in to the forest, where you're likely to find fungi, medicinal herbs, different methods for growing food in the forest, harvesting timber, making your own structures from it. And so I came back really with that as my focus, and the last 25 years has been sort of revolved around that.
When I recently sat down and read the latest edition of The Woodland Way, your revised and updated version, you address permaculture in that. Where did you encounter permaculture, and how did that become part of your practice?
Okay. Permaculture, I encountered first through the Visionary series. We had a television series over here, which there was a number of different visionaries outlining their sort of views on the planet, people like Manfred Max Neef and Bill Mollison. And Bill gave this piece called In Grave Danger of Falling Food, and I saw that. And it kind of clicked to me that there was a real message there, and I looked more into permaculture. And having been involved over the years with different types of sort of land-based practices, I mean, I trained originally as a shepherd, I've worked on fruit farms, I've done a lot of horticulture and broad-scale farming. And what was lovely was permaculture kind of sort of removed all of those sort of tags of particular disciplines and looked at land as one, well, more than land, but at the time I was focused mainly on land as one sort of overall system that we can then design and work with. And so I was inspired, and I fairly soon after that did a permaculture course here in the UK. And I think it was the second course that was held in the UK, so quite a while ago now. And that was, yeah, very eye-opening, opened up a lot of thoughts for me and kind of helped weave into the ideas I already had for what I wanted to do in the woodlands back here. So, yeah, very key moments in my life, finding permaculture and, yeah, doing that design course.
One of the things that I liked about your book, and this is one of the pieces that I want to talk to you when I do a longer review about it, and I will say that the only thing that I've read of yours, other than some of the material on the web that I found, was The Woodland Way.
Okay.
But I found, though, that as a permaculture book, I think that it's more about what the permaculture community needs in the literature and the material, because it speaks to me as such an authentic and honest work, because this is what you're embodying and doing. When I spoke with David Holmgren, a lot of what he suggested was that the community needs to connect people with what their personal calling is and then have them adapt permaculture to that work, rather than trying to fill the same niches over and over again. And I have to admit that because of where I live in the eastern woodlands of Pennsylvania, after reading your book and interacting with some other people I know who are doing woodland management and foraging, like tending to zone 4, that one of the niches that I would like to personally explore is that idea of becoming a woodsman in the area where I live.
Right. Okay.
And I just liked it because permaculture seemed like a very important part of the book, but it wasn't what you were focusing on, that it was taking those ideas and applying it to what you do.
Yeah, I'd say that is very much the approach. I mean, what is kind of unique, really, I guess, in the situation I'm in is that I'm dealing with woodlands that have such a long-term history of management. And that management has been sort of kind of, although partly there's been years when it's been missed out, the skills and traditions of, and the craft work that goes with managing, in particular, coppice woodlands, is kind of already a fantastic permaculture system in its own right. So for me, it's more been a matter of tweaking that and bringing more of the human element in and looking more at the diversity, one of products that one can make, which are coming out of the woodland, but also engaging more with the improving biodiversity side of it, which maybe has always been seen as a byproduct of woodland management rather than actually focusing and designing that into how one works.
And part of that that's of deep interest to me is one of the questions that I get is how can we use permaculture to make a living?
Mm.
And your material really expands on the idea of not just primary, but also the secondary and tertiary products that someone could develop from woodland management and have multiple, if you will, price points at which to interact with their community in order to make a living. That it's not just, well, I'm going to create poles for this and just do this, this, and this. That, you know, with the round wood structures you can build and the idea of certain materials you can weave into fence panels, others you can split for rails for building fences. It's pretty incredible. This diversity that you're developing.
Yeah, no, totally. And I guess what's exciting about it is that there's always something new. Every year I like the idea of, you know, although there's particular products that I make from the wood which are either traditional or I have good regular markets from, but there's always something new that springs up, and there's something you maybe I've been making for a while that one year doesn't prove so popular, and I can go back to that in a few years' time. Meanwhile, we'll make something else. So I guess I have focused very much on the materials that are useful in buildings and materials are useful in sort of garden and farm use. But alongside that, I do get specialist requests from local people who want just something unusual made of wood, be it the other day had a request for a chicken house, and we made that and made a shingle roof for it. And the person we made it for is a chicken breeder, and they put it up on their website, and now, you know, they've come back and said, can you make a load more of them? So suddenly something like that out of nowhere will come, and we can adapt with the type of woods we've got to being quite versatile in what we make.
That idea of making a chicken house, one of the things that I have on my list to make is a top bar beehive.
Okay, yeah.
Now I'm thinking about the coppice. I'm turning some of my property into some coppice stools. No, that's not right, is it?
No, well, you could be turning it into basically turning into woodland that you're managing as a coppice system. I mean, maybe I should explain coppice system. Would that be useful?
Yes, if you could, because the techniques I think are very easy to understand, and that's where in trying to frame my next piece that I got kind of caught up on. But it's creating this small woodland on my own property, thinking about how I could use round wood and coppice material to create top bar beehives rather than buying lumber was where my thought was going with it. But yes, if you could explain that, it'll be a great refresher for me and the listeners.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, coppicing is a process that certainly over here in England we know has been going on for a few thousand years. But the basic process is with broadleaf woodland, deciduous woodland, we go in during the winter season when the leaves have fallen off and the sap is sort of gone back down because it's colder, and we cut the trees during that dormant period. So it's just purely over those winter months. And then when spring comes, rather than the tree having died off, it's like a heavy pruning. The sap rises and new shoots come out. Now, those new shoots, we then grow on as a multi-stem tree until they reach a particular size that we need to make a particular product from. So for making some of the fences, we allow them to grow on for 5 to 7 years and then cut again. For making a building, we might let them grow on for 30 years. But there's a whole system of these woodlands throughout the UK, and there are in different parts of the world as well, as some different parts of Europe, there's some in Japan, and I know there are a few people working with it in the States as well. So this system basically gives you a renewable supply of poles of a particular size. And the real beauty of it to me is that this is a process where the human element is so important in the management of the woodland. For example, I have nightjars that come into my woodlands. Now, these nightjars, they're migratory species. They come in from Africa every year and nest in the same woodland. Now, they will only nest in freshly cut areas. So if I stop cutting the coppice, the woodland will grow up into higher forest and the nightjar will have nowhere to come to. And the same applies to a lot of varieties of butterflies and a real varied amount of ground flora plants that are established with this pattern. It's kind of like a patchwork of opening up a small area, letting in the light, then that grows on and you open up another area. And I say this process is one where humans are positive in the system. And it's quite hard to look at designing systems where the human element is actually a really needed part to increase biodiversity. The real benefit then from the system is the byproduct is the timber that comes out when you coppice. From that, we then make this sort of range of different products, which can be as versatile as one is as a craftsman to convert the round wood into the finished product. Some of the oldest woods in the UK, we've got like Bradfield woods in Suffolk is well known. There's records of that of monks going back 1,000 years ago, coppicing that particular woodland, and it's still being coppiced today. And the beauty is that as the years have gone by, the biodiversity has just increased and increased. To a recent survey on that woodland showed that it had more ground cover plants in that woodland than they could find in any other woodland across the UK. Just an amazing system. And there's also a wonderful social side of being a woodsman that's gone with it for over generations of people learning particular skills from particular size poles that they've then passed on. And it's kind of that side of it as well is a real interest to me.
That's very helpful. I'd like to talk about some of that social side, but before we move to that, I was wondering about this coppicing and it being such an old system. As you are coppicing, do the stools that you're creating eventually die out? When you say that this one area has been coppiced for 1,000 years, are those the same root systems over 1,000 years, or is that this space has been replanted and managed in different ways for that time?
Some of the root systems are the original ones. What tends to happen in this particular woodland I'm mentioning, in Bradfield Woods, there's a lot of hazel, ash, and with things like the ash trees, they basically, as you coppice each time, what happens is the new growth comes to the outside where the sapwood would be on the tree, and the middle part eventually begins to rot away. So what actually happens is you create this outer ring, and as it gets bigger sort of over so many hundred years, this outer ring gets wider and wider. And then what will happen is a new tree will seed in the middle of that ring and start growing again. But the existing tree sort of can spread out over a big area across sort of, you know, 5-6 meters over time. And there's been a little bit of work done as well, testing. They found a very old coppice lime area in a particular parkland, and they've actually done tests to trace the genetic origin of it and found out that it is actually all one tree, and that they reckon is a couple of thousand years old. So it seems like where woodlands are coppiced, the trees tend to live longer than if they're just left to grow as a standard tree. Amazing systems.
I think of a tree that I have, a Norway maple, that I was looking to try to reinvigorate because it was not doing so well. And one of my friends who has a background in forestry, his recommendation was to go through and to prune it heavily, to remove about 30% of the limbs that were there to try to force that kind of a growth. Now, regretfully, that tree has started to split at one of the crotches from the trunk that goes up. The trunk has like 7 main leaders coming off of it at about 6 feet off the ground, but that's starting to split. So I'm probably going to wind up dropping that tree at this point. But looking at these different ways that pruning and trimming forces this kind of youth and vigor into our trees.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that is the basis of what coppicing is doing. And certainly the coppice that's kept on what we call a shorter rotation, in other words, the poles are grown for sort of 5 to 10 years, tends to be a lot more vigorous and healthy than the coppice which is grown on a 30, 40, 50-year cycle.
On that 30, 40, 50-year cycle, can you get furniture-grade lumber from that kind of a rotation?
There certainly will be amongst it. I mean, it's very much having a diversity of products, because you always get some timber that comes out which is a furniture-grade timber, and then you'll get other timber that's not so good. So you've got to find uses for all of it, and therefore one tends to find that you create markets, you create styles of furniture that reflect the materials that are coming out of the woods. It's kind of designing from what the wood is giving you rather than trying to force the design of a particular piece of furniture you want to make onto the wood. The saying we have here is, you know, don't make a table out of a bit of wood that doesn't want to be a table. You know, make something else from it. It's kind of working with the wood, and rather than trying to sort of always force our ideas upon it. I mean, I think one thing to me as a woodsman is when I walk around the woods, I can see what's growing in the trees before I fell them. And that's by the shapes, by the patterns I can work out. And quite often there's 4 or 5 different products coming out of one stem of tree, but you've got to be able to recognize which bits to use for which.
It reminds me of a question that I received at a live workshop. Someone asked me, well, now that you practice permaculture, how has it changed your life? Like, how do you really apply this in your life? And my response was, I no longer try to conform the world around me to my goals. I conform my goals to what I can get from the world around me. And it seems kind of, you know, esoteric way to look at it, but I'm not inflicting or imposing what I'm doing on the world, rather, but trying to find a way that what I do works within it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That makes total sense. Time scale is one of the beauties I get out of working in the woods. I mean, I walk around the woods with people and they're asking me things, and generally I'm talking in, you know, 30 years, 50 years, sometimes 100 years. And I often get people saying to me, you know, you think in such large time scales, but I think when you work with trees, you do think in very long time scales, because obviously the lifespan and times of trees is far more than our lifetime and span. And therefore, you kind of are able to sort of see ahead. I guess for me, the woods I've got here, it's kind of like I've inherited sort of hundreds of years of previous woodsman's work. You know, my time here in the woods is almost like a sort of flutter of a leaf. You know, all I'm doing is trying to improve the biodiversity, get the woods back and up together so they're better for the next generation. And when you're working in that way, you're working in time scales that don't, you know, there's no sort of six-month contract you've got to reach. You know, it is all very much looking at the landscape in a very, very long picture. And I think doing that is a really healthy way of kind of training your mind to be able to think long-term and think about future generations rather than just dealing with the here and now.
Though I'm relatively new to permaculture relative to practitioners such as yourself and others, I've only really been doing this in a deeply meaningful way since 2010. The more that I practice permaculture, the more that my perspective is multi-generational and intergenerational. I think it speaks to some of the things that you were saying. And it makes it hard when someone asks a question, well, how do you do this? A lot of times the questions are over a growing season or up until a particular plant will bear food. And I'm thinking of, you know, my grandchildren 30 or 40 years from now, stepping back away from that long view and interacting with that short perspective can be difficult sometimes.
Yeah.
The other question that I wanted to ask you about the physical side of things before we move to the social, when it comes to the tools that you're using, in the Woodland Way, you mentioned using a battery-powered chainsaw. Could you speak some to that chainsaw and some of the other tools you're using as I look to make this transition, if you will, to being a novice woodsman in the Eastern Woodlands? I'm looking to add some additional tools to my toolbox and wondering about some things you'd recommend.
For sure. I mean, the battery chainsaw it's new technology and it's at an early stage, but like most things with sort of battery technology at the moment, they're constantly improving. And as I live sort of off-grid here, I rely predominantly on solar and a little bit on wind for my power supply here. Having a battery saw that I can recharge off the solar and then go out and do my cutting is obviously a huge step forwards from using fossil fuels. It's also so much more pleasant from a noise point of view, from a health point of view. So, yeah, I'm really quite excited by the new battery technology coming in. Now, these saws are not good enough to go out and cut big trees with, but certainly for the small diameter coppice, they're fine. And I think in a few years' time, we'll have ones which will cope with bigger trees. And I think that will be, be great for all of us out in the woods. With bigger trees, there are traditional hand crosscut saws, which are very effective. Again, like with felling any tree, it's very much getting your cuts right, which is the critical part, whether you're using a chainsaw or a handsaw to do that. The crosscut saws are very, very good. Beyond that, the other main tools I tend to use here is the billhook or the handbill, which is, again, I guess a very British tool. It's kind of like a little sort of cross between, I suppose, a mini scythe and an axe. It's like a curved blade, and over the years, there's been hundreds of different models developed, all for different sort of purposes in the countryside. And for coppicing, certainly the shorter rotation coppice, the coppice is often cut with a billhook, but we certainly use it for snedding up. That means taking off all the side branches and shaping up the timber, and it's a beautiful tool to use, and spend a fair bit of time getting them good and sharp, and by the end of a sort of coppicing season, it's kind of become an extension of your arm almost. We use them for so many different things. Other tools we use a lot are things like froes and adzes. A froe is kind of like a piece of metal sort of sharpened with a handle on it to make it like an L shape. And we use those for splitting because we tend to split a lot of wood rather than saw it, because the splitting process prises the fibers apart rather than saws through them, and it gives you a much stronger piece of wood at the end. So we use that for making a lot of fencing, for making roofing shakes, that type of thing. Little adzes again for splitting out and shaping timber. Side axes. Oh, I could go on. There's such a range of beautiful hand tools for making different products that we tend to use.
I went looking for a good billhook in the United States, and they're kind of hard to find here. And I think the closest thing that I was able to find was a tool known as the Woodsman's Pal, made here in the United States, and it kind of has a slightly curved edge for chopping and hacking on the front side, and then it has a sharpened hook on the back that you can cut smaller canes with. I'll have to ask around to some of the blacksmiths I know to see if anyone makes a bill hook or would consider making one.
Yeah, I'm sure there will be. I mean, there was a blacksmith from Wales who made very good bill hooks who settled in Oregon. May still be around, a guy called Matt Spears, who was very good. So he might have some good patterns to follow. But, you know, any good blacksmith who can make tools, as long as they've got the pattern there, I'm sure they can make a fine bill hook.
This is really just a personal question I have from me, because I'm interested very much in the traditional forestry skills and tools. How did you learn how to handle some of the tools that you do? Is there still a tradition within Britain and the United Kingdom to teach that? Or was it something that you had to seek out and find instructors for?
It was very much something I had to seek out and find instructors for. I think now there's a great change in that. There's more people sharing skills and knowledge now. And this is, again, very much a permaculture approach to how people are working. Traditionally, anyone who had a real woodland skill, maybe they were a hurdle maker or basically a thatcher, making thatching spars for thatchers who were thatching roofs, they kind of held on to that skill and would pass it maybe through their family, but very rarely pass it anywhere else. It was kind of this sort of, this is my livelihood. If I pass it on to you, you'll know how to do it, and therefore that will threaten my livelihood. And I remember going out about 25 years ago to try and actually learn some skills off some of these older guys who were still out working in the woods. And I remember going to see a hurdle maker, and he was out in the woods making hurdles out of hazel. A hurdle is like a woven panel that was traditionally used for keeping sheep in penned, but nowadays it tends to be used as a garden fence, very attractive sort of woven panel. And he was making these, and I would turn up and I offered to help him, but he said no, he didn't really need any help. And he'd chat to me, but he would never, ever do any work while I was there. He would stop work if I turned up. He didn't want to show me anything. And I think that is very much the sort of the past generation of woodsmen, really, that had that kind of fear of sharing their skill in case it would affect their livelihood. Whereas, fortunately now, I think we're at a time where we know how important it is to give people these skills. We need to be sharing them. We need to be passing on land-based life skills and how to make things that we need. And therefore, I guess it's partly what I do myself, but more and more people are out there sharing the skill of how to use these particular tools and how to make a good quality roofing shake or how to make a beautiful chair out of a piece of coppice timber.
I'm really glad to hear that this is expanding and that there's a possibility for more people to get involved so that we can keep these skills and traditions alive. And also just to be able to use them in our practices. part of my interest in this is that several of my past guests are people who are building without electricity or petrol of any kind. And in doing so, they're trying to figure out how to do this work. And a lot of it is they're finding that they have to recreate it as they go because it's just not available, or the people who know it aren't teaching it anymore. And I'd like to have more of this out there, because it's being able to go into the woods and do the work and still be able to hear the birds sing and not to scare them away.
Yeah, no, totally. I was chatting to an ex-apprentice of mine, Richard, and he does a lot of chair making out in the woods now. And he was describing making a rocking chair he just made. And, you know, I was saying to him, well, what do you really enjoy about it most? He said, well, I enjoy about it most is that there's no glues, there's no fixings, there's no need to visit the hardware store. I can start with a log in the wood and I can walk out of a chair and I never have to leave the woods. And I think that's just a privilege of a way to work and be able to start by felling your tree in the environment you're living or working in, and then to go through the whole process of turning it into the finished product and being able to do that without the need to think, oh, I need to go and buy some nails or some screws, or, you know, it's a good feeling.
And as you mentioned one of your apprentices, what about that social side of the work that you're doing, of being a woodsman?
Yeah, the social side is really, really interesting how it's developing. I mean, I think there is a really good sort of renaissance of traditional crafts and woodland management in the UK now, and not just traditional crafts, sort of modern crafts, things we realize we need now. I mean, there are products made out of the poles that come out of the coppice woodland that were maybe 30 years ago, I don't think there were people in England making yurts out of coppice poles. Now there's lots of people making yurts. So these are sort of products that, again, the coppice wood can be used for. So it's not just all traditional, there's modern ones too. But the social side is interesting. I mean, for me, I feel it would be totally wrong not to be passing on and sharing what I'm doing to other people. At the end of the day, there's a limit to the amount of years that I'll be able to go on doing this, and it's great to be passing it on to young people who are so enthusiastic to do it. I mean, at the moment, I have two apprentices, and I take on two every year, and they spend usually about 11 months with me, and they live in the woods, and by the end of it, they go off and start on a woodland of their own. Now, what's been nice around the area where I am in Sussex in the southeast of England is that over the years, a large number of those ex-apprentices have settled in the area. So there's a good network of people who've got these skills in the area who then, if a big project comes up, whether it might be a building project I've got on out of Roundwood, or it might be a large order for a fencing project, then there's a network of people to call upon. And the sort of, I guess, sort of this group of sort of ex-apprentices, they all see each other socially as well, work together a bit. So we kind of got this little woodland community that goes on within the area, which is great. And similar ones of those set up, you know, in different parts of the country where people are using these skills. I think if you work in the woods and you coppice and you make things from the woods, you immediately kind of connect with other people doing similar things. So yeah, it's the social side of it is good. And, you know, it's not to say that there isn't the odd social party that goes on in the woods as well.
I think about how, as you do more and more of this work, you find the things that are tasty when they become fermented and you wish to share them with your friends.
Absolutely. You got it. At the moment, it's spring here, and just at the beginning of spring. So, and spring's coming quite early. And at the moment, the birch trees, we tap the sap of the birch tree and make a wine from it. So we're doing that at the moment. We're tapping the trees. Now, the lovely thing about that is it's quite a quick wine. So in 6 months' time, by the time we sort of get to the autumn equinox, it's ready for drinking. And then at that time of the year, we're pressing the cider, the apples to make cider, which then are ready at this time of the year. So there's a nice sort of sequence even within what we sort of harvest and ferment as well.
You get to live in and enjoy those patterns of nature.
Absolutely, yeah. Very much part of it.
In our time together, I think we've covered everything that I wanted to talk about. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to the conversation for the listeners before we bring it to a close?
I guess I'd just like to sort of just mention a little bit about the immenseness of working within a woodland and the kind of magic of being out in nature, even in an area where I am, which is the southeast of England, is the most highly populated part of England. And, you know, there's certainly probably not got anything like the kind of space you've got maybe around you in different parts of the States. But even within here, just being out in that woodland, you can touch into something unique, ancient, and a sense of wilderness, which can be there, you know, right on your doorstep, even on the edge of cities. I know people who work in woodlands on the outskirts of the cities, and they can still kind of find that place there. Our woods are amazing places, and they're so versatile and so diverse, and there's so much that they can offer us and that we can make from them as well. And yeah, they're just the best place to hang out and work. So they're my inspiration, and I just love to share that with everyone and hope that everyone gets out there and appreciates them more.
Go out, reconnect with nature, do good work, and enjoy it all.
That's it.
Well, thank you, Ben, for joining me for this conversation. I loved your book, and it's encouraging, especially here, for folks in the United States who might be on a forestry path or from a forestry background, to look at a way to do their work differently and in a regenerative manner. So thank you for everything that you're doing and sharing it with us. I really appreciate it.
That's a pleasure. Nice talking to you.
And that was Mr. Lawl. You can find out more about him at www.ben-law.co.uk. And of course, you'll find a link to that in the show notes. What I enjoyed about this episode is the encouragement to seek out not only the tools, but also the knowledge to do what we feel called to do. To create a better world, we have to seek out what it is that matters to each of us and be our own solution. Another takeaway for me was in that long view. As Ben spoke about the shifting perspective of time, so do I see it that if we're going to think about tomorrow and well beyond, then it requires a shift in our mindset to look further into the future and imagine what could be, not just for the next generation or the one that follows, but many generations down the line. For a good reminder of that, listen to Matt Winter's The Gift. Finally, I'd like to know how your perspective has changed since discovering permaculture. How do you look at the world now compared to before you began studying this system of ecological design? Let me know. Email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or give me a call, 717-827-6266. You can also get involved in the conversations at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast or follow the show on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.